Well, should I trust you, Ron? It's on? Okay. Good. Okay. Well, let's talk about methodological naturalism versus methodological neutrality. So as a constraint on scientific theorizing, then, we're going to talk about, obviously, methodological naturalism as a restriction to explanations being deemed scientific to material causes operating within the constraints of physical law. So in other words, methodological naturalists are basically adherents of the mechanical philosophy, something that came to the foreground in the 17th century. Methodological naturalism then requires explanation in the form of a mechanism instantiating efficient material causality. That's the basic picture. Nothing else is going to do if you're an adherent to methodological naturalism. Now, some might say that the mechanical philosophy purged Aristotelian formal and final causation from an understanding of nature. I don't think that's true. I think that honor goes to Darwinism. So within the mechanical philosophy, for instance, while you placed emphasis on the search for efficient material mechanisms, formal causes were retained in an understanding of the conceptual design of the mechanism, which was conceived of as intentional, and final causes were retained in the form of the purpose, the mechanism that was designed to serve, as matching means to ends by nature's designer. If you want to see formal intent realized through purposeful implementation purged from science, that comes with the acceptance of Darwinism, which, while not offering an explanation of life's origin, nonetheless purports to explain the origin of different biological species and the growth and complexity in the history of life by means of natural selection operating on random genetic mutation. Okay. And Darwin's view of this process, although there's some equivocation. He has frequently stated things like, there seems to be no more design in the variability of organic being and the action of natural selection than the course in which the wind blows. So if you want to look for a place where theistic metaphysics, if you like, is rendered ineffectual and odious as regards the foundations of science and its pursuit, and the completion of the conception of the causal closure of the material universe, as the modern scientific conception, that rests with Darwinism. Now, I want to say that we'd be better off with a conception of methodological naturalism as we conceive of the practice of science, because while much lip service has been paid to methodological naturalism through the history of science, if you look at physics especially, and on into the 20th century particularly, efficient material mechanisms are not much in evidence. So when I say methodological neutrality, I'm not recommending that scientific theories be understood instrumentally, that is, kind of pragmatically and non-realistically, so as to set aside questions of the metaphysical implications regarding scientific methodology. But rather, I would suggest the policy of following the evidence to the best theory available, regardless of its metaphysical implications. Now, in the context of this, we all have to recognize, of course, that there are limitations to science. There are many areas to which science cannot speak directly. It can't demonstrate guide to truth without bringing in question by employing those methods. It can't be used to argue for the presuppositions which govern its methods, namely that the universe manifests a universal order that's decipherable by the human mind. It can't speak directly to questions of the ultimate purpose or alleged lack of purpose of human existence or for the universe as a whole. It can't tell us what we ought to do, what's morally right and what's morally wrong. But what about methodological naturalism? Isn't it at least necessary to impose it as a constraint on scientific explanation? Well, let me say this. If scientists wish to retain certain theories and research programs as part of science, then I think they're going to have to reject methodological naturalism, that is, efficient material causation, as a necessary constraint on scientific theorizing. But if they do that, then when we move to biology, they'll have lost their basis for rejecting intelligent causation when the evidence warrants it as an explanation in science. So which theories would scientists have to reject as violating methodological naturalism in order to exclude intelligent design? Well, if you look at things historically as they developed, Newtonian gravitation because of action at a distance, general relativity because of its implications that the universe had a beginning at which all causality breaks down, and all manifestations of quantum theory. So let's explore those ideas. But let me make sure that the fundamental point is grasped. Metaphysical naturalism is going to assert that the physical universe is all that exists, so that a proper understanding of anything must ultimately be given in terms of material efficient causality. So the metaphysical naturalist insists on the causal closure of the material realm. So any theory of physical phenomena that's put forward that's inconsistent with metaphysical naturalism, that is, which can't be understood in terms of a closed system of causes and effects involving only material constituents, must therefore violate the strictures of methodological naturalism as well. So if there are widely accepted scientific theories that on analysis reveal themselves to be inconsistent with metaphysical naturalism, we may conclude that methodological naturalism is not in fact operating as a restriction on science. So it may be set aside when circumstances warrant it. And as it turns out, it has been frequently warranted in physics and cosmology, and I think there's very good reason to believe that circumstances warrant it in certain aspects of biology as well. So what about Newtonian gravitation? Well, in the absence of field theory, but even with field theory in the Newtonian context, changing mass at one point instantaneously changes the values of the field everywhere else without any material mechanism being proposed. So you have instantaneous action at a distance. And what can we say about Newton's attitude towards this? Again, Robert pointed to ways in which he hoped or held out for a secondary cause. I do think he was a little bit ambivalent about the question. He did redirect mechanical philosophy from a preoccupation with corpuscularianism and contact mechanisms to consideration of forces, the mathematical treatment of which doesn't require any account of the provenance, any account of their source. So the fact that mathematical description of universal gravitation seemed to entail instantaneous and unmediated action at distance provoked a lot of debate among the mechanical philosophers and a host of untenable proposals. It wasn't until field theory came along and then Einstein's general relativity that you had some semblance of a mechanism. So here's the famous quote from the General Scholium to the 1713 edition of the Principia that comments on Newton's attitude towards this question. I have not as yet been able to discover the reason for these properties of gravity from phenomena, and I do not feign hypotheses. For whatever is not deduced from the phenomena must be called an hypothesis. And hypotheses, whether metaphysical or physical, or based on occult qualities or mechanical ones, have no place in experimental philosophy. In this philosophy, particular propositions are inferred from the phenomena and afterwards rendered general by induction. Of course, it's also no secret that Newton saw God's hand as active in the course of nature. Also from the General Scholium, we have him remarking as follows. Though these bodies, speaking of the solar system, may indeed continue in their orbits by the mere laws of gravity, yet they could by no means have at first derived the regular position of the orbits themselves from those laws. Thus, this most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. It appears that Newton is an advocate of intelligent design. Now, Pierre-Simon de Laplace comes along, 1800s, and develops the nebular hypothesis, and famously, in presenting it to Napoleon, and Napoleon asking him where God is involved in this whole thing, he says, "Sire, I have no need of that hypothesis." Well, how might Newton have responded? Well, he might well have responded that Laplace evinced a certain blindness to the incredible precision of the required initial conditions of his differential equations. Of course, in the modern context, that gets explained by as an environmental parameter. You have enough solar systems in the universe, one of them by chance is going to get it right. And so you have that kind of appeal to chance as a deus ex machina for naturalistic explanation. We might also respond by saying even at that time, field theory was not really on the horizon in a substantial way, so Newton's gravitational equations that Laplace employed entail an instantaneous action at a distance and constitute a non-mechanical mathematical description of gravitational effects that have no discernible material cause. So Newtonian gravitation seems to violate the strictures of methodological naturalism. Should it have been dismissed on those grounds? No, of course not. All right, now what about relativity theory and the Big Bang? Einstein, I think, was kind of a quintessential methodological naturalist. He was deeply troubled by the inconsistency of Newtonian mechanics with Maxwell's electromagnetism, but he was also bothered by the fact that the forces of nature have no materially restrictive conditions on their source or operation in Newtonian mechanics. And his first stage in resolving this difficulty was the special theory of relativity. He postulated that the laws of nature should be the same in all inertial frames and that the speed of light in the vacuum was a universal constant. And one thing that fell out of this analysis then was a radical revision of Newtonian mechanics. He established the speed of light as the limiting velocity in the universe for efficient material causality. Okay? Now, he also perceived the need for a general theory of relativity that would incorporate accelerated reference frames, not just inertial ones, but he was also bothered by the action at a distance in Newtonian gravitation. And so his reconceptualization of the theory of gravity as mass energy affecting the structure of space-time through gravitational waves that propagate at the speed of light was a means of resolving that difficulty. So that's the basic picture. What can we say about the implications of general relativity, though? Well, not only does it predict the existence of black holes as a result of gravitational collapse of supermassive stars, it also indicates that all past-directed geodesics are incomplete. They can't be infinitely extended into the past, and therefore the universe itself has a beginning. Now, that was firmed up by the Hawking-Penrose theorems in the 1960s that demonstrated that all space-times in general relativity have an absolute beginning. And the implications of that are a violation of, are not something that's readily interpretable within metaphysical naturalism and therefore run contrary to methodological naturalism. And this is why it took a long time for the Big Bang to be accepted as a standard picture within cosmology, even though it was a clear implication of general relativity. So you have Hoyle, who coined the term Big Bang as a pejorative, making the following remark back in 1975 in his textbook on astronomy. Many people are happy to accept this position. The abrupt beginning is regarded as metaphysical, that is, outside physics. The physical laws are therefore considered to break down at time equals zero and to do so inherently. To many people, this thought process seems highly satisfactory because a something outside physics can then be introduced at time equals zero, and by a semantic maneuver, the word something is then replaced by God, except the first letter becomes a capital God, in order to warn us that we must not carry the inquiry any further. So Hoyle's attitude, or Jastrow, who is an agnostic, telling the story about the scientists climbing the peak of rational thought and discovering that theologians have been waiting there for centuries for him to arrive. Okay, so the Big Bang violates methodological naturalism's explanatory constraints. And it was resisted initially because of its violation of the methodological provisions associated with methodological naturalism. But overwhelming evidence, not just in terms of the mathematical basis in general relativity, but its evidential foundations in the Hubble expansion and the discovery of the cosmic microwave background and the explanation for the nucleosynthesis of the lightest elements, won the day. And the Big Bang is now the received view in cosmology, although there's much discussion surrounding quantum cosmology and an attempt to obviate some of the conditions surrounding the initial singularity. So, should methodologically naturalistic presumption lead us to reverse our decision about the Big Bang as the received model? Well, no, of course not. Now, what about quantum theory? Well, Since the laws of physics break down at a singularity, a lot of cosmologists attempt to deal with the earliest stages by postulating a different physics at the beginning of the universe. Big Bang cosmology tells us that the whole universe was once very small, and they conclude that since it was once very small, it needs a quantum description of some sort. So quantum cosmology was born out of this. Now, what can we say about quantum phenomena? Well, they exhibit unmediated action at a distance, among other things. So let's take a look at an argument that would seem to run contrary to methodological naturalism. So naturalism's the view that the sum and substance of everything that exists is exhausted by physical processes, physical objects and processes, and whatever causally depends upon them. Now, the explanatory resources of materialism, therefore, are restricted to material objects, causes, events, and processes. But neither non-local quantum correlations nor, in light of a phenomenon of non-localizability, the identity of the fundamental constituents of material reality, can be explained or characterized if the explanatory constraints of naturalism are preserved. That is, if methodological naturalism is preserved. But these phenomena require an explanation. So, therefore, materialism, physicalism, so on, is irremediably deficient as a worldview, and the methodological naturalism that's associated with it as a strategy needs to be, at the very least, qualified heavily. Now, Einstein was deeply bothered by quantum mechanics. He talked about the spukhafte Fernwirkung, the spooky action at a distance that it represented. And he put his finger firmly on it in a 1935 paper that he wrote with Podolsky and Rosen that first described the phenomenon of non-locality. So he derided the entanglement of the wave functions in quantum theory that led to the prediction of non-local correlations as this spooky action at a distance that he wanted to eliminate. Well, it wasn't until the 60s that John Bell managed to reformulate Einstein's conception of the completeness of physical reality in terms of an inequality, the Bell inequality, that allowed it to be tested against quantum theory. Well, what's happened with that? In 2001, the inefficiency loopholes in the tests of the Bell inequality were essentially closed by experiments conducted at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and conclusively demonstrate what every other experimental test of Bell's inequality had revealed since the early 1980s, namely that Einstein was wrong about physical reality. Quantum theory, in terms of a mathematical description, is complete. Well, what do we get, then, out of that picture of reality that comes out of quantum phenomena? Well, we get quantum jumps, quantum tunneling, and quantum teleportation. So discontinuous, instantaneous jumps between quantized energy shells and atoms without an intervening physical existence. Quantum tunneling behavior through classical potential barriers and instantaneous spatial relocation of quantum entities. We get non-locality, that demonstrate the ubiquitous existence of instantaneous action at a distance without a mechanical cause as part of the fundamental mathematical structure of reality. We get instantaneous non-local collapse of the wave function. In quantum field theory, a local event in the quantum vacuum as kind of the fundamental state of empty space, a quantum field with the lowest energy, if we have a local event there, it can instantaneously produce any state of the entire field throughout the universe. That's a consequence of the Rey-Schlieder theorem in algebraic quantum field theory. And also, incidentally, the basis of the Boltzmann brain problem in inflationary cosmology in the string landscape. Then we have various non-localizability phenomena. So unobserved individual particles, if you assume that they can't serve as an infinite source of energy and they can't be two places at once, you can show that they don't exist anywhere in space at all. In other words, they don't exist. Quantum field theory really doesn't have a particle interpretation. And that result holds even if you suppose that there's a privileged reference frame. So in short, there's no intelligible notion of microscopic material objecthood. You also have the failure of material identity in quantum statistics. In order for an entity to be a material individual, it must be numerically distinct from other members of its kind in a way that allows differentiation. And that's not the case for either Bose-Einstein or Fermi-Dirac statistics. And then you also have a failure of material identity in quantum field theory, because field quanta can exist in states of superposition of particle number. But material individuals cannot exist in numerically indefinite states, so field quanta, whatever they are, aren't material objects. Deep problematization of materialist assumptions and materialist causality in the context of quantum theory. So Feynman's assessment, Richard Feynman says, the more you see how strangely nature behaves, the harder it is to make a model that explains even how the simplest phenomena actually work. So theoretical physicists have given up on that. That's his assessment. Well, what should we think about that? You can't really take a refuge in instrumentalism to defend methodological naturalism. Feynman adopts this instrumentalist attitude, but if you deny that quantum theory can be interpreted realistically and insist only that it be used instrumentally, then you cannot claim that the theory is methodologically naturalistic without making an assumption about the nature of nature itself in the background that begs the very question at issue. And that's especially true when the facts of quantum behavior beg explanation, as they do, and when, as we've seen, no physical explanation of them is possible. You can't take refuge in instrumentalism to avoid the falsity of methodological naturalism in the quantum theoretic context. What about other interpretations? What about Bohmian mechanics, for instance, which privileges the position representation and adds another equation to quantum description? A non-local second-order quantum potential field or a guiding equation, pilot wave, that renders determinate trajectories for all of the constituents of quantum systems. Well, it has manifold technical problems, and it really doesn't resolve the difficulties it sets out to address. So it solves the measurement problem in the non-relativistic case, but the quantum potential field, the guiding equation, carries no energy momentum. So it acts in a non-local manner that is both undetectable and non-mechanical. And since it does not, indeed cannot, serve the needed role then as a physical mediator of cause and effect with respect to particle locations, it too violates the strictures of methodological naturalism. And then it's fraught with insurmountable technical difficulties regarding trying to cast it in a Lorentz invariant form, and it can't account for particle variability as standard quantum field theory would under strong external potential couplings. It can't account for the existence of antimatter, and when you extend it to quantum field theory, it renders the measurement problem unsolvable, and that was the very purpose for its creation. How about Everettian many worlds interpretations? Well, the basic idea there is that the wave function doesn't collapse, but rather everything happens. So instead of the wave function collapsing, reality divides. And with each and every event in the history of the universe then, we get a new universe created, as many universes as there are inherent quantum possibilities. How am I doing for time, Rob? 2 minutes. Okay. Well, with the instantaneous creation of new universes with every quantum event, you have a radical non-locality introduced again that lacks a physical cause. So there's a violation of methodological naturalism there, and there are severe problems with the interpretations of probability in the many worlds analysis. All right, so when we descend into the microcosm below us, into the inner workings of matter, we find what Einstein objected to, causal incompleteness, spooky action at a distance. But we discovered that Einstein was wrong in that intuition. Quantum theory is not incomplete as a mathematical description of reality. Therefore, the conclusion must be that physical reality itself is incomplete. It lacks an intrinsic or immanent sufficient cause at the most elementary level of its existence. It's not self-sustaining. And since a cause that maintains physical reality in existence is a metaphysical and logical necessity, and no cause intrinsic to physical reality is able to satisfy this need, the requisite cause must be extrinsic to physical reality, transcend it, and sustain it. That's what the principle of sufficient reason requires as the bedrock of scientific rationality. So, quantum theory, in other words, spells the end of the mechanical philosophy as having hegemony over physical theory, And this, in turn, spells the end of methodological naturalism's hegemony as a constraint on physical science. But what should we say then? Do we now reject quantum theory as an outstanding piece of 20th century science because it violates methodological naturalism? Well, of course not. Now, there are information problems in cosmology and problems of fine-tuning that would seem to violate methodological naturalism. The multiverse, of course, is dependent upon the truth of quantum theory and the descriptions of quantum theory, and in its inflationary manifestation also has a beginning, so there are problems with methodological naturalism there. There are problems in biology as well, and Polanyi observed this back in the 60s when he wrote a couple of pieces, a couple of essays, Life's Irreducible Structure and Life Transcending Physics and Chemistry. The basic point that he made is that with regard to the DNA molecule, the sequence of the nucleotide bases along the strands is independent of any physical or chemical principle. You can't explain the ordering, which carries the information of the DNA molecule, of the nucleotide bases along the sugar phosphate background in terms of their N-glycosidic bonds that hold them there, because those bonds are chemically indifferent to the identity of the nucleotides. And that was something that would have to be the case if DNA is to have substantial information carrying capacity, but then the origin of the information itself has no physical explanation. That was Polanyi's fundamental insight, and it's the insight that renders origin of life research so difficult. So let me conclude then by just jumping to some... Because a lot of people claim that intelligent design doesn't offer a research program, but it does. Let me indicate or conclude with just a few predictions in biology that would follow from an intelligent design hypothesis. So, first of all, no undirected process is going to be able to demonstrate the capacity to generate 500 bits of functionally specified information starting from a non-biological source. Informational accounting is going to reveal that sources of active information, and that's a particular technical conception that emerges out of the work of Marx and Dembski on evolutionary computation, that sources of active information are responsible for putatively successful computer-based evolutionary simulations. Functional sequences of amino acids in amino acid sequence space should be extremely rare rather than common. Future experiments will reveal that RNA catalysts, that is, ribozymes, lack capacities necessary to render the RNA world scenario plausible. Informational accounting is also going to reveal that any improvements in replicase function in ribozymes are the result of active information provided by ribozyme engineers. Investigation of the regulatory and information processing systems in cells will reveal the use of design strategies in hierarchically nested logic that mirrors, though likely exceeds in complexity, the strategies implemented by computer engineers. Cell biologists will find regulatory systems that function in accordance with a logic that can be expressed as an algorithm. If ID played a role at the origin of life, but not subsequently, then prokaryotic cells should carry amounts of genetic information that vastly exceed their own needs or retain evidence of having done so. And molecular biology should provide evidence of structures at the base of life that are rich in specified information exceeding the generative capacity of undirected physical processes. Furthermore, if a designing intelligence acted discreetly in the history of life, both at its origin and subsequently, then prokaryotes need not carry genetic information that exceeds their own needs, but the history of life should show both anatomical and molecular evidence of polyphily rather than strict monophily. In particular, episodic infusions of information into the biosphere and anatomical and molecular homological investigations may well evince discrepancies that are inconsistent with the idea of a single tree of life. Also, in the possible case of strong polyphily, ID predicts the genome of one species cannot, maintaining continuous functionality, be transformed into the genome of another species by random rearrangements, since this would comprise the regulatory formatting of the respective DNA molecules. And lastly, if the ID hypothesis is true, then studies of putatively bad designs may well reveal either a hidden functional logic, perhaps related to the constraints of a multiple optimization of the properties it possesses, or evidence of decay from a good aboriginal design. So there's plenty of material here for a research program, and in fact it's being pursued at places like the Biologic Institute and the Evolutionary Informatics Lab. So let me leave things there, and I was going to talk about the place of science at a Christian university, but maybe we can reserve that for later. So thank you, and are we due for coffee now?
So, yes, it's now reserved time. I think we're okay if we